position number 13273, reel 1.
Spooner, reel 1.
Can we start with your telling me about the work that you did training the Air Guard?
Well, the Civil Air Guard was one of the several schemes which the government started around about 1938, I think it would be, in order to have a reserve of pilots for the war, which they began to realise might be soon coming. And it was a scheme under which fit young people, for as little as five bob per hour, could learn to fly up to the standard of something like about 5 or 10 hours solo. And I was instructing at the Liverpool District Flying Club at Speke, and we had a great intake of these people. In fact, we bought 2 or 3 extra aircraft in order to train them, and we had ordered a lot more, but war intervened. And these people came from very poor backgrounds very often, and on the whole proved most valuable material. And it was quite interesting because they came under sort of two different forms. One was the very brash young youth, used to come on a noisy motorcycle usual, and he was a bit of bravado type, and the chance to learn to fly at 5 bob per hour was something he couldn't resist. And the other was a much more quiet and responsible type. And after a few hours flying, they both leveled out completely. The brash people lost their brashness, and the shy people increased their understanding and became more open. And flying did that to them. It taught the brash people the need to look after themselves and to use judgment, and it brought out the shy people and the knowledge that they could fly. It was a very interesting experience in my life.
So they came from a social background which normally wouldn't have provided people as flyers?
Oh, one or two might have had enough money to learn to fly, but I doubt if any of them did. But most of them came from extremely poor background.
Did they make good flyers?
On the whole, very good.
But how much did you enjoy doing the work?
Oh, I enjoyed teaching people to fly enormously. Because you saw them expand, you saw them gain, gain confidence. I think it's one of the most enjoyable periods of my whole flying life. I love teaching people to fly.
Now, the second thing I'd like to go on to is the first time you flew in a Spitfire. Can you tell me what you remember of that, please?
Well, I remember. I shall never forget it. owing to the fact that the round about the period, it would be round about just before Christmas or almost Christmas Day, 1940. And owing to all the bombing that had been going on, not only was the railway system in a hell of a mess, but as far as I could make out, the RAF posting department was in a hell of a mess too, because I was just suffering from extraordinary series of postings. I'd been posted all over the place and no one ever knew what to do with me. And I finally arrived. I'd just been on a Wellington OTU, taught to fly Wellington at an OTU without a crew, which enormously embarrassed the OTU, because normally crews arrived there. I'd been taught to fly Wellington by a man who couldn't fly Wellington. And in fact, a companion called Sosanas and myself had to teach ourselves to fly Wellington. And we were hustled down to a place called PRU at Benson. And PRU was rather secret, and it took a long time before I could even find anybody to tell me what PRU stood for. And finally, somebody told us it stood for a Photographic Reconnaissance Unit, which gave Sandy and I an awful lot of thought. We thought, what on earth are we going to do with Wellingtons on Photographic Reconnaissance Unit? All we could think of was we would have to fly over at night and somehow take photographs at night, because we hoped very much it would be at night anyhow. I arrived with this PRU, met by a very nice Australian flight commander, a chap called Desch, his first question was, "Where have you come from?" He mentioned the number of OTU. He looked a bit puzzled. He said, "Are they Harvards or Battles?" We said, "Well, I said, neither." He said, "Well, do they fly there then?" We said, "Wellingtons." So there's a bit of a silence. I think one of us said, "You know, what are we going to fly here? Wellingtons?" And he said, "No, Spitfires." So we looked at one another. We thought, "Well, that's very fine, but why have we been to a Wellington OTU to fly a Spitfire?" He said, "How many hours you've got?" Well, it so happened, because I had been a commercial pilot before the war, I had over 2,000 hours. He said, "Christ," he said, "that's more than anybody in the station's got." He said, "Well, obviously," he says, "you know, you chaps know how to fly." So he said, "Well, normally we check people out in a Harvard, even though they come from a Harvard or Battle OTU. But with your experience," he said, "no. You know, you won't need checking out." He said, "Anyhow," he said, "somebody's pranged the Harvard." It was a very wet December. So he said, "Come along," he said, I'll show you the bits and pieces." So we walked up to a Spitfire, and he undid the flap where the pilot gets in. And he said, well, this is that, that's the instruments, that's the flaps, that's the undercarriage, there's the intercooler, there's the gills, there's this, there's that. And you know, he was a good breezy, a very efficient Australian. And he said, "Now, have you got all that?" And I may have asked a question or two. He said, "Right." He said, "Well, off you go." And so someone started the engine. He said, "Now, there's one thing you've got to be very careful of." He said, "These things are a bit nose heavy." He said, "It's been raining a lot. The whole airfield was one quagmire nearly, and had no runways." He said, "Be very careful taxiing," he said, "because the thing is liable to tip on its nose." And he left me with about a long downhill taxi in mud, downhill at that, too. And this thing saw several times, almost started to go on its nose. And of course, I was taxiing very, very slowly. Another thing he warned me, he said, "Don't let the temperature get more than, I forget, 140 degrees or something like that. Don't let the temperature rise to more than 140 degrees. Well, it's long, slow taxi downhill, downwind, and the temperature was about 150 degrees by the time I got to the bottom. So I turned it round into wind, waited, hoping into wind would cool it off. And I waited, and it showed no signs of cooling off at all. It was still about 10 degrees over what he told me not to let it get. I thought, well, anything you do now is just see if the damn thing will take off. So I opened the throttle, and we charged up this slight rise, and I had been flying, before I'd been flying Wellingtons, I'd been flying Ansons, and the dear old Anson, one of the slowest, most reliable, easy-to-fly aircraft in the world, and the thing just staggered off the ground and obeyed slowly. So anyhow, it was the very early mark of Spitfire, Mark II, I think it was, or Mark III. Anyhow, it was that very early mark where you had to pump up the undercarriage. You selected up, and then you pumped, and eventually the green lights came on. Anyhow, we charged up this hill, a lot of engine torque, which I hadn't experienced before. I'd only been flying Tiger Moth, Wellingtons, and Ansons, and none of those had engine torque, so I had quite a job to keep it straight and also to keep the wings level owing to the engine torque. And the thing leapt off the ground eventually, and I was very anxious, glancing at this temperature gauge thing, and the temperature gauge began to go down. Then thought, well, now I've got to get the undercarriage up. So I select it up, and you've got to pump. And of course, it's quite instinctive. As you pump, you move the other arm, and the spit must have been climbing up in slow degrees. Then I began to think of the other things he told me to do. I've got to close the gills, I've got to change the pitch of the prop. Things I'd never flown an aircraft, but you had to do any of these things to before. Get the flap up, that's right, do this, do that. I said, well, that's fine. Now I think I'll complete the circuit. And I'd been used to flying Ansons as much as anything else. So I looked over my side to see, as I expected, the airfield, which is what you do at an Anson. I discovered to my horror that I was 7,000 feet above cloud with no maps and going about 200 miles an hour, just heading in the direction in which I had taken off. and there was no sign of anything at all. And there was I just started climbing into the blue, no airfield, of course, and somehow I'd gone through a layer of cloud whilst I had my head in the cockpit, you know, trying to work out all the things that Daesh had told me. So there I was in this very Spitfire, you know, going like a bomb. So I turned it round on a typical heading, found a gap in the cloud, and came down underneath and tried to find out where I was. And I found the main railway lines flying out of the main railway lines from Paddington going west. Well, I knew by the compass where I was flying, and it was a pretty shrewd idea this was the old Great Western Railway line. And I flew along there. See, fortunately, I'd learned to fly at Brooklands, and rather blasily as an advanced pupil, we used to fly all over the south of England without even maps. You know, I don't know why we did, but we rather prided ourselves that we could fly without maps. And I eventually found Reading on the... And I recognised it by the Huntley & Palmer biscuit factory, which I knew very well exactly where it was relative to the railway station. And I'd changed trains at Reading the night before. I'd gone along to the nearest town to Benson is a town called Wallingford, and I'd taken a branch line. We'd changed trains at Reading, and I'd gone to, up this branch line. The Reading is quite a large railway junction, and it took about two shots to find the right branch line. I was flying, I suppose, about 100 feet now in this Spitfire, terrified of meeting balloons. I knew there were balloons all around the bloody place. And after about two shots up various branch lines out of Reading, I found Wallingford. And I'd spent the night at the George Hotel, Wallingford. And I flew around about 50 feet until I actually found the George Hotel. All is about 140 miles an hour in a spit. And then I tried to remember how I'd got to Benson from Wallingford. You can't see much from 50 feet or 100 feet. And anyhow, I eventually found myself back to Benson. And with a great sigh of relief, I completed the circuit and came in and landed. And that was my first flight in a Spitfire.
Can you tell me what impression the plane made on you as an aircraft at first?
Oh, it was a gem to fly. It was an absolute gem to fly. And it was no problem to fly, to take off and land or anything. And the thing was, it was very responsive on the controls, and it was no problem to fly. But I'm very sad because with due respect, the one job which I would have liked in the war more than any other, well, two would have been, I would have enjoyed night fighting. The one job I would have enjoyed perhaps more than any other would have been PRU. And I've been posted there by accident, and within a month I was posted away partially because I failed the altitude test, and partially because I've been trained on Wellington. They really wanted me to go to a Wellington squadron. But I would have loved PRU because I was always perhaps more interested or as interested in navigation as I was in piloting. I always found it easier to navigate than to fly, nearly.
Now, if we can go on to your operational squadron 221, which I think you joined in January 1941, can you tell me about its role and how you fitted in, please?
Well, after more frantic postings, I eventually arrived at 221 squadron, which was then based at Bertram Newton. And this was a Wellington squadron, and it was the first Wellington squadron ever to have airborne radar. In fact, it was one of the first, I think it was one of the two or three first squadrons in the whole of the RAF to have airborne radar, which was known as ASV, air-to-surface vessel. And the object, so we were told, was we began to work up as a squadron. It had just been reformed. It was the World War I squadron, which had just been reformed after being disbanded in 1919. It had just been reformed at Bertram. And the object was we were going to work up at Bertram to become an operational squadron, and then we would go out over the Atlantic from some base somewhere on the West Coast and look for U-boats. And this wonderful gadget we'd been given, ASV, would enable us to find the U-boats, and that was the theory. So we were all rather excited about this, especially as none of us had ever heard of ASV. At that time, there wasn't an ASV set on the station. And it was so top secret that no one would tell us anything about it. We said, well, what is ASV? It said, it's top secret. Which is all very well, but we were supposed to use the thing. Anyhow, they gave me a crew, which was very nice. I'd never been given a crew before. And my first, strangely enough, my first co-pilot was a naval lieutenant of the Fleet Air Arm. I was an acting pilot officer, and he was a naval lieutenant. So on the ground, I more or less had to salute him, and in the air, he called me sir. It was quite an interesting situation. And he only lasted about 3 weeks, which was a pity, because he was a very nice chap, and we got on very well.
In what way did he only last 3 weeks?
He just got posted away. I think there was a time, especially during the Battle of Britain, I know there was a time during the Battle of Britain, when virtually all Fleet Air Arm pilots nearly were being posted to the RAF. And I suppose, so somehow he had got on the tail end of that, and somehow all I can assume is that the thing was cancelled, or else they wanted him for a more responsible position, rather than being a co-pilot of a Wellington, in the Fleet Air Arm. I don't know why. It was nothing to do with his performance. So we worked up, and I had a very nice co-pilot. He'd been to the school of GR too, so he could navigate. And the rest of the crew were the most extraordinary collection. I had three WAPAGs, you know, wireless operator air gunners, who could barely work the wireless set and couldn't work the gunners at all. Couldn't work the guns at all. And I had a navigator who couldn't navigate, but he was a flight sergeant. And in January 1941, flight sergeants were, oddly enough, few and far between. They were quite elderly people, highly regarded. This chap must have been at least 10 years older than I was. And he'd been in the RAF, man and boy, I think he was ex-Halton originally. He'd been in the RAF about 15 years. Whereas I was in the RAFBR and very new, and I was rather frightened of him at first, because he's much older than I was. And flight sergeants were very highly regarded in 1940 and 41, and he used to come along to me every morning and salute and say, what are your orders for the day, sir? Well, I never had any orders for the day, nearly. But the first thing I discovered about this little chap, a Jersey man, called Wavell, we all called him Chiefy Wavell, but he couldn't navigate. He not only couldn't navigate, he hadn't the faintest idea how to navigate. He didn't know what a course and a track were. And there we were, supposed to go out in mid-Atlantic with a navigator who didn't know the difference in a course and a track. So with much deference, I had to say to him, when I found out he hadn't the faintest idea how to navigate, I had to say to him, no, with all due respect, Chiefy, how come you came to be an observer? They were called observers then, and later on they were called navigators. And it's quite an interesting story. He was an armourer by trade, and he'd volunteered for flying duties. He's a brave little chap. He's only about 5'2", I suppose. And he'd found himself in France on a battle squadron. Those poor battles, they got shot down in droves in France. Because he was an armourer, he was the rear gunner. Because he was the rear gunner, he was the observer. And he navigated, if you can call it navigating for a battle, by map reading. So that made him a navigator. But he'd never done a nav course, and he never had to bother about courses or tracks or anything like that. Because he was a trained armourer who volunteered for aircrew duties, he became a rear gunner. Because he was a rear gunner of a battle, he became an observer, and that made him a navigator. But he was extremely useful to me later on, because when I found out that the three WAPAGs virtually couldn't fire their guns, they couldn't clear stoppages at all, I immediately put them in charge of my navigator, who was a trained armourer. So my navigator trained the gunners how to fire the guns, and I taught, because I had what in in commercial aviation before the war, I had what was a rather rare thing then, a second class or even a first class navigator's license. So I taught my navigator to navigate, and he taught my gunners to fire the gun, and we got on splendidly.
How much success did you have in the U-boat hunting in 1941?
None. Almost none of us found U-boats, because over the Atlantic, and the very few that were spotted, none were attacked, as far as I know. Very, very few, I think one or two might have been sighted, were sighted visually, and not with this wonderful device, this ASV. Because the ASV, ASV Mark II, to give it its full name, was a very elementary form of airborne radar. And it lacked the sensitivity and definition to pick up a U-boat in the Atlantic. The Atlantic rollers were much higher than a U-boat. As you probably know, Admiral Dönitz built up this wonderful U-boat service on principles of a very, very small U-boat, much smaller than most of our fleet submarines, with very low hull altogether. So it would be very hard to find, and certainly ASV Mark II couldn't find a U-boat. It might find a U-boat in dead calm water, but you don't get dead calm water over the Atlantic. So we hunted, and this ASV. Also, of course, we weren't told how to use it. If we asked how to use it, it was top secret. And see, I had my three WAP AGs who'd been trained to fire the guns by Chief E. Wavell. I had Chief E. Wavell, who I taught to navigate. But none of us had ever done an ASV course or radar course or even been told the principles of radar. We had to work it out for ourselves. And I'm sure we weren't applying it correctly. Although we did have, as a squadron, we had a number of about 8 or 10, or 8 about ex-commercial pilots, some quite elderly people, and we were not particularly service-minded, because we were a number of civilian captains of aircraft, and we did dig into it, and we found out quite a lot about it, but not the official way. There was a very bright Jewish pilot officer, I don't think he was a captain of aircraft, called Wiseman, and he was a brilliant brain, and Wiseman taught us a lot of, in fact, Wiseman gave us the principle of radar. And Wiseman dissected, a few sets for us. But I'm sure he wasn't supposed to. But as a squadron, we got a lot of use out of radar, but not for the use it was supposed to have.
What use did you put it to?
Well, the first thing we discovered was that although it wouldn't find a U-boat, it would find land from water. And we were operating from an isolated station in Northern Ireland called Limavady, not far from Londonderry. And it was extremely useful to us because we had very inadequate Met. There are no Met stations in mid-Atlantic. I would say mid-Atlantic is an exaggeration. We used to go out about 500 or 600 miles and then turn around and come back again. And with no Met, and but this time, Chiefy could navigate all right, but I think so several of our navigators weren't all that bright in the squadron. And the problem was to get back to Limavady, because we'd been out by 10 hours by then, about almost with unknown winds, and we might come back anywhere. So it's extremely useful for finding Northern Ireland in the first place. And we soon learnt there's a little island off Northern Ireland, you probably never heard of it, called Tory Island, T-O-R-Y. And we soon learnt the juxtaposition of the blips between Northern Ireland and Tory Island. And we got a shrewd idea where Tory Island was from time to time. And we knew where Tory Island, then it was relatively simple to find Limavady after that. See, we came back at night as often as not, too. And because above all, it wouldn't find a U-boat, but it would find a convoy. So when we were sent out to escort a convoy, or to circle around a convoy, the radar would find us the convoy. And this was very necessary, because in the first place, owing to our lack of adequate Atlantic Met, we could be miles out of where we thought we were. Second place, the convoy was liable to have altered course without letting anybody know in order to avoid U-boats. So the convoy was liable not to be where it was supposed to be. We were liable to be where we were not supposed to be. And until we discovered it ourselves, I'm not even sure we discovered it at that time. I'm not so sure I didn't discover this on my second visit to Olimba Valley. We discovered our compasses were out. And I found this out fairly early, and I used to use the sun compass in order to check the magnetic compass. And what was causing the compass to go out was that we put a second ASV set on board alongside the co-pilot's position. There was one by the radio. They put a second set so the co-pilot could watch it as well, about a foot away from the compass. And it was soft down. So it was just causing the compass to. So we had a faulty compass, no met, and we're looking for a convoy which might or might not be where it's supposed to be. And I think some of us, I wouldn't say chiefly by now, some of us had suspect navigators. Actually, I was doing my own navigation on what they call a Bigsworth plot. For the first 6 months, I did the navigation with Chiefy as well, and we checked it together. It's a thing called a Bigsworth plotting board, a big plotting board which I kept on my lap. But he became so adept at it afterwards I didn't need it later on, although I used it again later on in Malta. So it found our convoys, and it found Northern Ireland, and this was very important to us. And then a group of us, mainly the ex-commercial pilots again. You see, in the RAF, if you're born and bred in the RAF, there's a certain discipline. You know, you mind your own business, or you do what you're supposed to do. But we were all intakes, and we didn't... You know, if we had a bright idea, we acted on it. We weren't particularly... subservient in the chain of command. And a group of us got together, and because Limavady is on the edge of a lock, there's a lock, the lock on which Londonderry is, an inlet of water, and because it told us water from land fairly plainly, once we found Tory Island and we got to the lock, we worked out a descent through cloud procedure on it using the lock. It was quite complicated because ASV Mark II is not easy to interpret. In fact, it's very difficult to interpret. We had no planned position indicator, and it was just a straight line with blips on it. But Eric Starling and myself in particular worked out a letdown through cloud procedure on it. So although it wasn't finding U-boats, it was being extraordinarily useful to us. And we even began to home on to the radar on this screen. We were getting a lot of jagged lines jumping down all the time, interference, electrical interference, and we noticed that when we got near the convoys, the electrical interference increased. So we had this idea that it was increasing because, although we didn't know it, we weren't told this, we assumed that since we had radar, we assumed that some of the naval ships had radar. No, we weren't even allowed to ask questions about it. So it occurred to us that this electrical interference might be from British ships' radar. And by tuning the set right down to absolutely zero, we found we could home onto the convoys on the electrical interference.